Today, coffee is one of the most consumed beverages on the globe. And Brazil holds the title, with Vietnam not far behind for coffee production. Its origins began in Ethiopia at least 1,100 years ago and crossed the Red Sea into present-day Yemen. It was planted in the backyards by Muslim dervishes. The remaining pulp of the coffee berry was used to make wine. From there, it spread throughout the Muslim world to India, Italy, and the rest of Europe. Although it's a drink we all know, its roots stem from a rebellious past, as it was banned by churches and governments alike. Here in the United States, specifically Boston, the Green Dragon, recognized as the first coffee house, served the caffeinated bevy next to tea and beer. But more importantly, it's one of the places people like John Adams and Paul Revere planned the rebellion that would lead to the American Revolution. KTRT presents Curious Lightning, the show, The Bean. I'm your host, Dakota Clearwater Lacroix. Coffee is that ritual libation, that drink of the gods, and with the birth of the modern espresso machine in Milan, Italy in 1945, it gave way to instant coffee and vending machines, and the institutional coffee break was born. A Dutch native living in California named Alfred Piet opened the first Piet's Coffee and Tea in 1966 and chose to focus on roasting small batches of fresh, high-quality beans. It was a trainer to the founders of Starbucks that now has over 16,000 stores in 40 countries.
When everything is lonely, I can be my own best friend. Coffee and the paper, have my own conversations. With the sidewalk and the pigeons and my window reflection.
But no matter, coffee is intimate and personal. From driving through the night to be with that love, or adding just the right amount of cream and sugar, with the house's occupants holding a morning calm prior to going to work, we perform our own little acts of rebellion every day. And I was curious to find out more about what was transpiring with two present-day caffeinated sorcerers roasting and producing some of the finest coffees in North America. In the first half of the show, I traveled to Canada to speak with roaster and co-owner Ann Boxer Wishlow of Oso Negro in Nelson, BC. And in the second half of the show, we'll speak with Dan Donahue of Blue Star Coffee Roasters in the U.S. So what was the initial spark for you for coffee? What was that little moment, or did something happen in life, or was it a slow progression, or did you have an aha moment for coffee and wanting to go down that path?
I developed a taste for coffee in high school, but it wasn't always the best quality coffee.
Were you cramming for late night tests and
university? Yeah. Yeah, and even a pot of coffee wouldn't always keep me awake. But then being introduced to Oso Negro and John and the Petrocini, I was their second ever barista to be hired. And so I got to be really involved with watching the process of coffee unfold, and the creation and the artistic side and the science side, and being part of... I've always enjoyed trades and creativity, so it's kind of it melded together for me. And through a variety of scenarios that happened, I did get the opportunity to get thrown into roasting just one day. And that's a long story why I got thrown into roasting, but I embraced it and I was ready for it. And John guided me through, and it's been a passion of mine since before I pulled my first roast.
Yeah, I think, I wonder, you know, for a lot of us coffee drinkers, I don't think we understand, myself included, where the magic of it being actually grown in soil. There's hands and humans involved, Mother Nature involved. And I think that's kind of revealed for a little bit for us as we are becoming a more intelligent coffee drinking culture. But at its simplest level, like what took you from that first cup, you know, in college to roasting? Like, was there some like elemental magic behind knowing that it was a grown commodity, seeing it come in beans? And can you explain just a little bit of that from farm to our cup, so to speak, in the most, you know, in terms of, you know, how it first kind of kicked off for you and what it is today?
Yeah, I mean, there's a human sense to it, right? It's humanity at its finest. So it's a place where you can sort of travel the world by sipping on different coffees, and we all of us can't always afford to go to these tropical destinations, but you can in a cup of coffee. And the purest form of coffee, I think, you know, drinking a black espresso is a magic, and it honors the bean itself and the people that grow it. You know, when you imagine the farmers in Guatemala, and, you know, hand-picking each cherry, carrying it, the heavy, heavy cherries in baskets to a main depot, and having, you know, going through the drying process, and it's very hands-on for them, and there are machines involved, but not always, right? And it's extremely laborious. We've got it easy on our end. You know, I feel like they're doing the majority of the work, and hopefully through the fairly traded drive, they're getting paid a better price for all of their work to reinvest in their farms so they can keep growing and passing it on to their generations, their families, to come. It's amazing, and it's sustained itself. It's got that's the great thing about coffee, right? You can keep replanting as long as you respect the soils and you give back to the soils, and then the coffee does grow on trees.
Well, since coffee is pretty much grown around the center of our globe, I needed to head further south. So I enlisted the help of Curious Lightning contributor Melanie Mers. And as a new transplant to New Orleans, I asked her to go out and collect some of those stories. And this is some of what she got.
There was this one time, and it's a story of unrequited love. And it was Super Bowl weekend, and I had to work the night shift. And so the cafe was basically empty. But there was this PhD student who was working on his thesis, and we started talking, found out he was from Russia and liked a lot of the same things that I did, and, you know, both liked soccer and those sorts of things. And so we weren't really paying attention to the football game, even though the Colts ended up winning that year, but we just hit it off really well, and he left with, you know, telling me that he'd be back soon and hope to see me again, and it was very sweet, and I was really excited about it, but he never came back. And I didn't know what had happened, so I figured he wasn't that interested, and I went on with my life and met someone new and started dating them, and I had graduated and decided to move, and I was doing one of my last few shifts at the cafe, and who should walk in the door but this Russian guy. And he didn't really walk in the door, though. He hobbled in because he had a cast on his leg. And so, you know, I said, "Oh, hi, how are you doing?" And he was like, "I am so sorry. I'm so sorry I didn't come back. But the day after I met you, I was playing a soccer game, and I broke my leg."
The day after.
The day after. And he didn't know my name. He didn't know my phone number. He didn't know anyone else who went to the coffee shop that I worked at. So he didn't really have a way of getting a hold of me. And so, you know, I was really touched, you know, because he obviously, you know, he told me that he had really liked me and wondered if I had a boyfriend. And I said, "Well, actually, now I do have a boyfriend." And he said, "Well, that's too bad, because my plane leaves for Russia in a week, but I would have stayed longer, you know, had I known."
If you didn't have a boyfriend, he would have stayed.
He would have stayed. He would have canceled his his ticket and stayed just to get to know me, or, you know, whatever.
Did it make you question your relationship?
I really wish it had, because that one didn't work out at all. So, but, you know, I've learned from that to usually your gut's right, you know.
I've been trying to do it right. I've been living a lonely life. I've been sleeping here instead. I've been sleeping in my bed. Sleeping in my bed. So show me family, hey! All the blood that I will bleed, hey! I don't know where I belong, hey! I don't know where I went wrong, hey! But I can write a song, hey! I belong to you, you belong to me, my sweetheart. I belong to you, you belong to me.
Like, what are some of the trends or the shifts that you've seen from just the way people are tasting or talking about it on just an even gut level?
I feel that, you know, it's our part of our responsibility to educate our customers as much as we can, pass on information. And the bigger corporations do that in a grand sense, but then those questions come up for us. So, you know, we've been supporting Fairly Traded Beans since from the beginning, from our inception, but not everyone knew that. So we would share that in dialogue with customers on the phone or that came into our establishment in the beginning. But then to have the bigger corporations push it on people, I think that, you know, humans want what's best for humans, generally speaking. So when you can, you know, support our organic status, and you know that the farmers are not dealing with chemicals and pesticides, and they're staying healthier and happier because of it, then it gets passed on. So I think it can really promote us, you know, together in the coffee world, as long as you keep the quality high, you know, and you respect the people that make us who we are. It's our customers.
Well, I think that translates into, you know, when you do something you love, that comes out, whether it's a cup of coffee or building a bridge or you name it. And so I think often with companies like yourself in the small, you know, there's passion behind a lot of that. And I think that does translate in the cup for people.
Yeah. Hopefully the passion stays high. It is passionate and it's always changing. So we get to stay
Well, of course, there's the human element, right? When,
absolutely,
you know, and somebody's having a bad day, they've just, you know, their lover just dumped them, and they're now making your espresso. It really, that's challenging, you know, the human element.
Absolutely. And and then hopefully with the team of coworkers, you can support that person and help them to see the light and still make a fine espresso with some love.
Yeah, within your working community, how do you guys you know, find what is that conversation that you're constantly having with each other about coffee, and just the to support that quality, and just in, you know, to keep the joy in all of it for you guys. How do you maintain that joy?
I think we try our best to support our coworkers. So we, you know, a fair wage, benefits of whatever sort we can offer, trying to support the lifestyle and why we're here in Nelson, and encourage people to come to work, but to also leave fresh. So we have shorter shifts at our cafe that's extremely high pace, and then you can go to the beach or go mountain biking or go sailing or do what you need to do. So trying to just support people in their real life and know that work is just kind of a stepping stone to the next phase of their life. You know, as for coffee, there's often conversation around our beans. We host cuppings at our roastery so we can keep the language developing for all of us, and the more we can teach, the more we learn ourselves. And it, and like I said, it's changing, as every harvest of a bean can be different based on that climate that year, or natural disasters, or pirating, which still happens, or, you know, there's so many elements in just getting the green bean to us. So just keeping conversation, communication. I mean, it's all about communication.
What are a few of those elements that the average drinker would have no idea about? I'm you know, I love that it's, you know, it comes from somewhere else in the world, like you said. But what are a few of those things that, like surprised you even, or would surprise somebody that, you know, from that coffee bean to showing up in our towns?
I think a big element is understanding where the bean comes from and how many processes that single bean needs to go through to become a fine espresso. So it, you know, it needs to be picked, the cherry needs to be ripened at its reddest to be picked, and then dried properly, packaged properly in this burlap sack and shipped in the right humidity, and for us to then store it properly at our location here at the roastery, and then roasting it to its finest capacity, blending it in one of our blends, grinding it properly for the process of drip or espresso, and then your espresso machine being the right temperature, the right pressure, the barista tamping it properly and wiping those grinds clean and pouring the perfect cup. There's so many elements involved. And I do believe a lot of people appreciate that already. But it's a good reminder, you know, even for me, just to respect each coffee bean and really try not to let one coffee bean drop on the floor.
I used to go to Seattle every year for a contract manufacturer for Millstone Coffee,
okay.
Cascade Coffee, out by Bowen and Mukilteo.
Okay, Mukilteo, you know all about it then. That's kind of crazy. So I didn't know, I thought Folgers was like from Central America.
Folgers is an American brand. It was Procter & Gamble, now J.M. Smucker owns it. And it's actually, 90% of it is manufactured here in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Who
all of the beans
that?
Come up the Mississippi, and then they're packed and roasted in New Orleans.
Okay, so they come up from South America?
All around the world.
Okay.
That, to me, I think, is part of that I guess, that give and take of the education of the customer when somebody comes in, especially in the U.S., they'll often order with a lot of terminology if they're new to a smaller roaster with Starbucks lexicon language.
Right. Yeah, and then we try to support our customers and remind them that the truest taste in coffee is coffee itself. So we don't offer syrups, and we try to, you know, offer our coffee in the purest form as possible. And that surprises some people, that they can't get at our coffee shop what they normally receive in a bigger company or in their city coffee shop. But, you know, there are so many different idiosyncrasies in each country, single origin coffee, that you can get caramel in a coffee, and you can get vanilla and grapefruit, and you don't have to add the syrups to receive that if you take the time to taste.
And so are on that note, are you within the coffee regions of the world, are you essentially trying different beans and on different years crops and finding those flavors and then offering those up as different drips? Or are you trying to highlight those unique personalities of each origin, or is that more of a complex mix and that goes into your overall blends? Like, is there a philosophy on that for you guys?
I think we take each country as itself, as its single origin, and taste that and understand how that would work with the blends we already have that are existing, which we have numerous, 24 blends. And with those blends, we've always encouraged people's feedback. So we started only roasting single origins, and then people wanted a little bit more flavor, maybe more body or more acidity or more of a finish. So we would add in another country and at what roast level we would decide on, depending on the flavor that we wanted to be highlighted. So over time, it's been a very careful and complex, like you said, blending process that we've tried to meet everyone's taste. And we try to retire blends sometimes, and usually within a day or two, somebody wants that blend back.
Are we looking at coffee the same in your eyes?
Will always be the people that will only drink drip, and that's great. But more people, I think, want that creation given to them. You know, I feel like we're privileged to be able to order some sort of fancy drink and for an affordable price, feel very special and feel taken care of. And maybe that's why espresso is just another element to our pleasures, you know. And I have to say that people they believe more in decaf, even though I'm not a huge supporter of decaf. But then it can be coffee for everyone, because not everyone can do caffeine. So now there are quality decaffeinated beans that taste like High Test. So there can, you know, it's become a bit more versatile, I think, you know, for a light roast or a dark roast, there's more selection available, so you can appease more people.
Are you guys constantly having a dialogue about that and tasting? And you have a machine, you know, near the roaster, and to me that says a lot.
Yeah, I mean, for us, consistency speaks volumes. So we're always testing ourselves and adjusting our blends so they will stay consistent depending on the different harvests of the year. As our cafe, we communicate with them daily. You know, we deliver coffee to them every weekday. Every day we roast, they receive fresh coffee. So, and we keep track of our numbers, of course, and we listen to our customers and see what they want. And if the espresso blend was too light, then we'll darken it up. Or if it was too dark, we'll lighten it up. And we're trying to really, be refined in what we can offer and be approachable and to whatever, be accountable for our service and our product.
One final question. Tell me something you don't want to.
I didn't see that one coming. Sometimes. No, I can't tell you that. Okay, I'll tell you. Sometimes in the morning, I put milk in my coffee.
You're going to hell for that.
Oh, I can't believe I just told you that.
You've just humanized your company even further. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Dakota.
Sour, too nice to be me. When on the top guy style, I'm not too keen. Try to change the world, I'm a plot and scheme. Mario C likes to keep it clean. Wanna shine like gay so deep. Fun radicals, that's my dream. More deep, I'll stick it to your
feet. If you're just joining us here at Curious Lightning, I have been discussing the art of coffee with Ann Boxer Wislow of Oso Negro in Nelson, Canada. In the second half of the show, we'll head back to the States to speak with Blue Star Coffee Roasters Dan Donahue, whom, along with his passionate co-creator and wife Meg, have been creating cups that are popping up on the coffee world's radar as some of the best. Let's take a break, and we'll be right back.
Somebody, and now he's someone else. Took apart his old life, left it on the shelf. Sick of being someone he did not admire. Took up all his old things, set them all on fire. He's gonna change his ways. His new life can start, and it feels like heaven.
I got into coffee pretty intentionally because I was like small factories, and I built a lot of different things, and I just like the way small factories organize and do stuff. I know a lot about a lot of different things that I've built, but coffee is what's interesting to me, so I worked really hard to get into the coffee business. And that's what I did 19 years ago, and I've been in it ever since, and I still find it interesting.
What is it about the bean? What got you hooked on the bean?
I go back a long ways to my mom just always drank a lot of coffee, and growing up in Seattle, it was pretty easy to find good coffee back when Starbucks was starting, you know, a long time ago, a few little companies getting started. So that had an awareness of coffee from a young age. Kitchen always smelled like coffee and all that kind of stuff. So I grew up to be a coffee drinker.
And what was the origin of your professional development?
Well, it's probably from dropping out of school and building pickup truck canopies for a little company, and got excited about a small factory, you know, and just the way these high quality units could be put together and get a control over the quality at every step of the way was interesting to me. So I worked for a little company, started off as kind of the lot guy and installer and stuff like that, and ended up, you know, like short time, like 3 years later, being the production manager. And I liked managing the production, a little busy shop, couple production lines, and just cranking out some really quality stuff. So I went back to school after that, and I got my business degree, and then but always was interested in small factories.
And what was it like being around Seattle 20 years ago, which is, you know, really one of the epicenters of coffee in the U.S.?
Yeah, and even before that, like 30 years ago. So I was pretty small when I became aware of that. And
oh, is it 30? Yeah. That means we're getting old. I graduated high school 10 years ago.
5 years ago. You know, it was really when Starbucks started. And so I was aware of that. And, you know, when I was a kid, if you needed a present for your mom for Mother's Day, you know, my mom would be a bag of coffee, and I could on the way home from school, you know, take the bus, get off at the stop, and there was a Wet Whisker, it was called. And that was before a precursor to Seattle's Best Coffee, Stewart Brothers Coffee, then SBC, and then ultimately Starbucks bought them. But those guys were great. And go in there and say, you know, be a little kid and I want a bag of coffee for my mom. And, you know, what does your mom like? I think she likes Sumatra. Oh, we have some of our Sumatra. You want to taste it? Yes, please. And they'd give me a little cup and I'd be like 12 and sip it. I think she'd like that. And great. They'd make me a bag of, you know, package it up and I'd.
Did you really get a tongue or a sense of taste for it, or did you just nod and go, it's like me and wine. I'll take that. But yes, that's very good. Yes, that
that's
bottle.
Not bad. No,
yes, please.
Those guys were all really focused on the bean back then. You know, it wasn't drinks and all that kind of stuff and all these value-added stuff. It was beans and coffee, tea, and spices. And so you go in there and they had that stuff. And it was kind of a low-key environment. Seattle was a much smaller city back then, and so it was just a neighborhood thing, and they would have that coffee, and yeah, you know, Sumatra's got the big body to it, and I was kind of aware of that, and I knew that she liked that, but you become aware of the different coffees and stuff. So I've got a good palate, my mom has a good palate, my dad has a terrible palate, so you know, just, you know, I don't have a super palate, but it's just educated, right, in coffee, so you just kind of know what to look for, and that helps technically when you're making coffee and decisions along the way.
Ice cream floats and have it in ice cream and uh-huh. and whatever. But I love coffee. My kids drink coffee. They're
kids?
Well, now they're getting up there, but my youngest is 14.
Okay. Wait, so they managed to grow even though they were drinking coffee?
Yes, they're very tall actually. My middle son, he drank lots of coffee. So the whole thing about coffee stunting your growth is
not
bull.
True.
Yes.
I feel
okay.
So left out. I didn't drink coffee because I was trying so hard to make it to 5'7".
He's about 6'3" now, and I think he's still growing.
I feel jipped.
We have size 14 foot, and it makes it hard to buy shoes.
So coffee inspires growth is what you're telling me.
Before you hit the roaster, what are you going through here to get as your, you know, what are some of those steps?
What's the process of making coffee?
Yeah, I mean, it's right. It's traded behind oil, and so beyond that, being an artisan roaster like Blue Star is.
So for me, it starts with an idea, right? So I've got an idea of a flavor we want to put in the cup, and then there's combinations of beans you use to get there. And what specialty coffee tries to do is really find those really exceptional coffees that are grown out there in the world, and rather than have them blended in with inferior beans or something else and just go along the faceless path, you know, you try and protect these things to be what they are, just a really nice beans that are, you know, represent a taste of place for how they're grown and how they're picked and how they're processed. And so you got all these great beans to choose from, and then I'll be looking very intentionally for a bean with certain characteristics. And work on, you know, and I've got choices in how I roast it and blending the beans together to get a certain flavor in the cup, depending on, yeah, that idea of what we're going for in the cup.
I mean, what's it like being a little guy on the market where these huge, these other companies who can, you know, order what, a mega shipping container? I mean, what is that perspective here for the average Joe like myself who has no idea?
It's what you're, you know,
or the scale, basically.
Yeah, the scale of it's amazing. So coffee is the world's second largest traded commodity. So petroleum's number one, coffee's number two. And that's amazing. So it's a really volatile commodity too. So it's bigger than, you know, cotton and pork bellies and all the other stuff wrapped together. You know, it's number two by a long ways. And most of the coffee grown in the world, I got to back up a step further. There's, you know, coffee is native to Ethiopia. It's native to East Africa. Everywhere else in the world, it's been transplanted, really in the last probably 150 years or less. So it's people just trying to capitalize on the positive attributes that coffee has. And
you went to the right? Didn't you go to the birthplace of it or a store nearby?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, lucky I've been able to travel a little bit and see some of that. So Ethiopia, spent some time there, seeing how they grow and pick and process and think about coffee. But every country, it's fairly important to them. It's important to them because it's worth so much money. And so, you know, Costa Rica and Central America, Guatemala, Mexico, all those places grow coffee. It has a distinct flavor. And then South America, Indonesia, a lot of places grow coffee now. That little magical band around the earth between Tropica Capricorn and Tropica Cancer. So you can grow coffee in those places. And so over the last 150 years or less, people have, entrepreneurs mostly, Europeans, have transplanted coffee to these other places. A lot of it through the benefit of colonialism, you know, and been able to plant coffee and develop the taste for coffee in the northern climates, especially. So Europe and U.S. and as an alternative to tea. You know, U.S. was a tea-drinking country 200-some years ago.
The British.
The Brits. You know, and tea was, a relic of, you know, the Brits, you know, colonialism, right? So Sri Lanka and India, places like that, they grow a lot of tea and bring it on home to the... where they drink a lot of tea, where it's cold and damp.
Because it's so hot in New Orleans to drink hot coffee in the morning.
Yeah, so do people drink hot coffee here in the summertime?
Yes, of course. In New Orleans, it's more about the chicory. Like, if you go to all the fine restaurants, it's going to be the community with chicory is served with real cream and...
So, can you explain chicory? People in the North do not know what chicory
is. It started because of during the World War, there was not, there was no money and no food. And so because there was little coffee to be had, they start taking tree bark and mixing it up in the coffee to make it last longer. So chicory is actually a type of tree.
Oh, it's wood.
Wood that goes in.
It's like an
additive, right. But it gave it that different flavor, which is what New Orleans is known for.
Is there a particular taste or idea behind coffee? Like, has it changed for you over the years as somebody who's seen it for a number of years? Like, do you have has your palate changed, or just the idea behind who you want to source from and so forth?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's fun to see the trends in coffee kind of develop, and they do. And there's and it's kind of be kind of dramatic. So even, you know, 20 years ago, you know, there was talk about roasts, and there was not a lot of agreement on what these different terms meant, you know, whether it's city roast or full city, or it's a Vienna roast, it's French, it's Italian, you know, and you can kind of agree on what those tastes or what those labels kind of mean. But you go to the East Coast and it's completely different from the West Coast. They'll just flip stuff around and it means something different. So, you know, from there it's gone to a dark roast. You know, you got to go dark or you're not gourmet. You know, it's like, yeah, okay. And then you can go, you know, now the latest trend, I think, in roasters is ultra light roast. And it's just like, you know what? I don't even like that. You know, it's sour. You know, but that's what the kids are drinking anymore.
I think Starbucks has an energy drink. Actually, I tried it, and it gave me the eye twitch. Green coffee energy drink.
Nice.
Green bean energy.
Wow, yeah. There's always people trying to push the frontiers of what's good and different, and that's interesting. You know, it keeps it interesting. There's people do a lot of stuff with green coffee and make it, study the health benefits of it and applying it to different parts of your body and, you know, getting something good out of it. And, you know, fortunately it tends to be positive, you know.
What's coffee pair up best with here? What's happening in the world or for you that's getting back to tradition or even kind of shifting and new in as far as being cupped with, you know, other things that we are starting to develop as well out there in the culinary world? Or
I think you know, people have an expectation for good coffee. That's great. You know, doesn't have to be fancy to be well crafted and taste good, and there's a lot of room there, you know, comparing coffee to wines, you know, and food pairing and how you taste it and how you drink it, and, you know, going for a certain flavor. But coffee, you know, in general, it's the industry's changed a little bit. So you see the farmers being more empowered, you know, and starting to make those connections a lot easier to what the farmer can do to increase the quality of their coffee, you know, and to respect that more, knowing that it's going to get respected on this side of the table, the consumers, and therefore make more money, you know, and get paid better for it and rewarded for their efforts and care, as opposed to the commodity thing. So you see much more of that, and the farmers making simple changes in their techniques, and
well, it's almost as if they're not in the shadow so much. A compliment is a part of the ingredient that goes into the process.
It's fun. A lot of those guys are working really hard, you know, to get the quality in the cup. And the way coffee works, you know, the farmer can do everything right. And boy, the weather, you know, the rains come sporadically or they come all at once, and that affects the harvest timing or what they can do in harvest and all that stuff. And they can crash their quality through no bad work on their part, you know, and just, so it's really, we always go back to cup quality. We taste it and see if it's got the characteristics we're looking for. You know, buying it blind doesn't do anybody any good. You really gotta, you know, we're strong believers in boy, if it tastes good and it's well prepared and handled and respected on that side and has those qualities, you know, yeah. That's the good stuff. That's what we buy, you know. Anything else is, you know, got old or has defects that are just, you know, not good. Well, there's really not a huge price difference between those two points. So let's, you know, look for the good stuff, you know, and work hard on that. And the farmers, you know, having that transparency there, and the farmers knowing that. So it's, you know, you deal with respectful people all through the process, you know. It's one thing for us to go to, for me to go to a farmer, you know, and taste their coffee or walk up and buy a bunch of it and have it shipped, you know, but there's really a lot that has to happen in between there. And it's the farmer grows the coffee and the processing to take it out of the cherry state, you know, and wash it and clean it and dry it to the right level and, you know, bag it up. And oftentimes that'll get mixed with other farms stuff to get a certain quality, you know, in that coffee lot. And then it's got to be, you know, shipped and delivered, brought from the mountains, say Guatemala, to even down to the port, you know, and not spend too much time, you know, taking out of the mountains and sit on the docks there, bake in the sun. It'll ruin the flavor. You can have shipping containers that leak, and, you know, so much stuff can happen between here and there. And then it's got to get into this country and pass customs and be accepted and tasted and stuff like that. So I can buy coffee subject to my approval. Which is seen us do, or I can buy some coffee in advance in Guatemala and farms that I like and know, and when it shows up in this country and clears all those customs hurdles, I get one more sample and I can roast it up, taste it, and decide, yeah, that's good, you know, that's within spec of what I'm looking for, and if not, I can reject it.
Would have a coffee klatch at about 4:30, 5 o'clock every afternoon.
What's
a coffee klatch?
I don't know what
that is. That's like a Jewish word.
Klatch.
A coffee klatch.
Is that like a little meeting?
Like a little meeting, come to my house and have coffee and let's gossip in French. And they would get together and they'd speak French because they didn't want the children to understand what they were saying, and we didn't speak French anymore. So they would come and together and drink coffee and speak French and gossip, and their way of thinking was that if they were drinking hot coffee in the afternoon, that was like cooling them off. Uh-huh. They would drink hot coffee and it would make them hot or perspire and like cool off, because you live in South Louisiana, it's hot here.
Eyes and ears for when that leaves their farm? Is there somebody that's kind of a surrogate?
It it's different in every country. So every country's got their own tradition. It kind of depends on, you know, how remote these growing areas are, and then what that country's personal investment is in the coffee industry and the infrastructure and all that kind of stuff. And it's, again, different everywhere. And their approaches to it are just widely different. And the way they pick and prep and package coffee depends on, you know, the natural resources they have available. If they have access to clean water, they can mill it themselves. Otherwise, you bring it, the cherry, to the mill and maybe do a co-op, and the farmers are involved in that and have some say over the price of their coffee and the quality of their coffee. They'll band it together and try and get as much money as they can for it. We work with some farmers who do that, and they'll roast and cup their coffee, each crop, each lot of coffee that comes through the processing, and taste it and rate it. You know, they're educated cuppers, and they rate their own coffee. And if it's fairly ordinary coffee, great, sell it to the commodity, you know, world, and it goes for a certain price. If it's got something special to it, boy, let's not sell it to the commodity market. Let's market it on its own merits. And doing that, actually cupping coffee and having an understanding in a common language for what quality, how to describe that coffee, the terms you use, that's new. You know, it wasn't done 10 years ago, really. And certainly not before that. You couldn't talk to a farmer and say, hey, tell you what, I'm from American, and I'd like to buy your coffee. And if you just change a few things, you know, I think I'd buy more of it. And they go, you know, shut up. You know, don't tell me how to grow coffee. We've been growing coffee for 120 years here. My whole family, that's all we do. Don't tell me how to grow coffee. You know, and it's like, really? I'll pay you more money. It's like, shut up. You know, get out of here. And so that was really a tough obstacle in the coffee industry to overcome. And some folks I know that have devoted their professional careers and lives and everything to bridging that gap, you know, are only now having success, you know. And they've been working on it for like 15 years, you know, but they're having success now, you know. And that's, people are starting to close the loop on that, you know, and understand, because coffee's different everywhere. You know, like we said, you know, coffee in different countries has its own history and its own way of, you know, how it's viewed. And in a lot of coffee countries, traditionally, they wouldn't, you know, if coffee is of good quality and clean coffee, you export the stuff because it's worth a lot of dollars. And if there's crappy stuff left over, that's what the locals drink, you know, because it's more affordable in that deal.
I've heard that from a few different people saying, you know, locally they can't believe what they're drinking in a particular country that's known for its coffee.
In a lot of places, you know, it'll be Nescafe or something like that. And they just don't have a cup. But, you know, when you're in the tropics, you know, a cup of coffee doesn't really sound that good anyway. You know, you're going to go ahead and drink the mango juice, you know, and not let the coffee go by, or drink tea or something, you know. But, you know, but that's changing a little bit. And, you know, Brazil grows more coffee than anybody that is a country, and they really grow it cheaply and as cost-effectively as they can for the most part. And what they drink when they drink coffee is just some really sour coffee. It's even got its name named after Rio. It's Rio-y coffee. It's the name of the defect. And it's just this terrible iodine, medicinal, bitey flavor. It's awful. So they'll do that, but they'll brew it super strong, lots of sugar and cream, and shoot it. You know, I'm sitting down and lingering over a mug of coffee. That's our perspective. But everybody does it differently. And so now they're like, the Brazilians are developing a taste for, you know, a cup of coffee or brewed different ways. And that's put some pressure on the market. They export a lot less coffee now because, hey, you know, they got people in their own country that would like to drink that coffee. So.
Yeah, their standard of living is rising with their economy as well, yeah.
In their sense, yeah, their taste and the tradition changes a little bit. You know, the new generation wants to drink, you know, something different than grandpa used to, you know, shoot.
Do you think, does Starbucks have an influence in those countries where they're showing up in, you know, the near the Berlin Wall and Red Square, and I'm sure in Rio, are they changing the culture for the locals there?
They totally do. They're tastemakers, you know, and so as they're setting up there, especially Asian countries, but India too is probably Starbucks' fastest growing market. They can put a lot of cafes there, and the young people do want to distinguish themselves from what their parents did in tea houses and traditional stuff, and like the the Starbucks experience, that whole thing makes them, you know, feel more Western, more professional, and all the stuff. And it is that professional class that didn't exist before. And it's, so it's their place, and they own it. You know, they want that. And Starbucks does a great job of doing that. And then small chains, and you know, but you know, local chains will do the same thing. And it's always interesting that Starbucks is not a big player on the world coffee scene. Just back to how big the world coffee market is, Starbucks doesn't even really show up on that, you know, with all the coffee that they do. You know, it's the really big guys, and it's, you know, Kraft Foods, who has a family of brands now, you know, that makes a difference. Nestle, you know, is a big player. There's big countries, big companies in Asia and stuff that are, I think, actually might even be bigger than Starbucks. I'm not even sure, but
I was gonna think the medicinal products, like the aspirins and the people that use the caffeine from the coffee bean, right? Those mega pharmaceuticals, perhaps.
Yeah, those guys, they just, well, might. There's enough of them, you know, enough decaf made in the world that as the caffeine's pulled out, there's that whole secondary market for the caffeine, absolutely. As that grows, you know, if you need caffeine to put in your Red Bull or your Coca-Cola, then, boy, you're paying for it, and that will show up in, you know, more decaf in the grocery store of a cheap, low-level thing, you know.
Final question here. Tell me something you don't want to.
I'm not really drinking coffee right now.
Anything else? Well, you are Irish, so.
Yeah, it's like coffee.
Dan Donahue, thank you.
Thanks, Dakota.
Way down among Brazilians, coffee beans grow by the billions, so they've got to find those extra cups to fill. They've got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil. You can't get cherry soda, 'cause they've got to fill that quota. And the way things are, I'll bet they never will. They've got a zillion tons of coffee in Brazil.
Well, that's our show. Thank you so much for joining me today here on Curious Lightning. I'm your host, Dakota Clearwater Lacroix, and a very special thanks for all of the artists who contributed to this show, and especially Melanie Mers down in New Orleans.
Politician's daughter was accused of drinking water and was fined the great big $50 bill.
If you want to listen to any past episodes or possibly contribute to the show to make it possible to be curious out there in the world, look us up, www.curiouslightning.com, or hit KTRT's Facebook page. Have a good one. See you next time.